Welcome to the Script Lab Podcast. I'm your fellow screenwriter and host, Shani Edwards. Today I sit down with writer-director Tim Disney about his new film, William. It's about two scientists who create a Neanderthal baby cloned from ancient Neanderthal DNA and decide to raise him as their son. I'm a huge fan of Neanderthals. I'm your people. I didn't know what the movie was about until I sat down to watch it. And then when I realized it was about cloning a Neanderthal, I like almost peed. I was so excited.
Well, that's wonderful.
But for those of my listeners who maybe don't know that much about Neanderthals, maybe you could tell them like what that means, what it is.
Well, a Neanderthal was another human species. And there are at least two other human species who are not Homo sapiens that we know about, and probably others that we don't know about and will likely discover through more sophisticated analysis of genetics, of genomes. The Neanderthals coexisted. They arose from a common ancestor about 400,000 years ago, and they coexisted with Homo sapiens for tens of thousands of years in Europe and the Middle East. They were physically somewhat different from us. They were a little shorter and stockier. They were probably not as good at throwing things as us. Their shoulders and elbows were constructed somewhat differently. They probably were not as good runners as Homo sapiens. They were designed for doing the ugly business of bringing down big game at close range. Interestingly, a lot of Neanderthal skeletons have the evidence of injuries that is very similar to what rodeo clowns get. Basically, they were in there up close with spears, killing large game and getting bowled over by large game. They were tough and strong. In terms of their culture, they were our equivalent when they coexisted with Homo sapiens for many years. They buried their dead. They had a sophisticated language, obviously. They created symbolic objects. It would be very hard, if we didn't know about what happened afterwards, to say one was more sophisticated than the other when they coexisted.
Gotcha. Well, I want to personally thank you for making a movie where you're trying to imagine what one of these beings were like, because they are still inside of us. I don't know if you've done your DNA, but
I got some too. Well, every human outside of sub-Saharan Africa does, because the founder population, and I'm going to nerd out on you since you asked me to, the founder population of Homo sapiens that left Africa, probably in more than one group, that peopled the rest of the world, meaning that every human outside of sub-Saharan Africa descends from this founder population, and that group was as small as 1,500 individuals. Yeah. So I'm just kind of an obsessive reader, and I got onto a little jag, reading jag, and read a bunch of books and information about the emergence of what we think of as modern humans. And there's two things that really stood out for me. One was that our existence as a species was never a foregone conclusion, that we just barely made it. You know, I find that to be humbling in a good way. Secondly, was all the discussion of the Neanderthals. And people talk about that in different ways, the gist of which is generally that Homo sapiens had some kind of cultural advantage that allowed us to succeed where they failed. And, you know, with the idea that history is written by the living, I thought maybe prehistory as well. Maybe that was not the case. Maybe they died out because they were more virtuous than us, not the other way around. That the special quality that we congratulate ourselves on, our creativity, our storytelling, has a sinister side.
Yeah, that idea is absolutely fascinating to me. So let's come back to that, because I want to talk about William. So you gave yourself permission to write a screenplay about two scientists that, you know, sort of throw all bioethics aside and create this creature. Was that exciting for you?
Yes. I mean, I suppose, you know, it's not realistic in the sense that disciplined science would probably never do such a thing. But it's all, you know, it's an allegory or for the leap of faith we all take when we decide to have children in this crazy world. Like, you know, no thinking, sensible person would ever have a child, right? Like, why would I bring a child into this world? And yet we do, you know, inevitably every time. Then we have this, women go through this horrific experience, actually give birth to a child. And then a few months later, they want to do it again. Like, what is that all about? And that's kind of a miracle. So I wanted the science to be realistic and plausible, but all in the service of the bigger story.
Right. So in some ways, this movie is a family coming-of-age movie, but in other ways, it's also a Frankenstein story. It has elements and Godwin and all of that.
Yes. And again, going back to the family metaphor, every father-son, child-parent relationship is a Frankenstein story to some extent.
What do you mean?
Well, we create these children, and we feel our job when they're young, and I should just say I, because I'm speaking as a parent, is to tell them what they ought to be, to keep them safe from harm, to take care of their needs, etc. And in the early phases, that is largely the job. But then it becomes clear that they are their own people, separate and apart from us, inevitably so, inexorably so. And then, you know, if one is a good parent, one realizes, oh, my job is actually to get out of the way of this person, just to make room for them so they can. But that's a hard thing to do. And the clash between those two instincts, I think, is inside every parent, present in every parent-child relationship. So yeah, every child is in some sense a monster that must inevitably come into conflict with the parent in order to become a whole person, a separate person.
Wow, I've never heard it described that way. I love it. There's a couple other themes in this movie. One is the theme of otherness, being different, and the other is what does it mean to be human. Did those themes resonate with you from the beginning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always saw the Neanderthalness as a really useful proxy for getting at those issues. And then I think the third thing is the sinister power of stories. You know, who controls the stories, how we use them without even realizing we're doing it to control our children on a domestic level, and to, you know, alienate, to define ourselves or to disdefine ourselves on a larger scale in society. And so one of the hardest things about writing the script was I knew that he had to be cognitively different. You know, physically he's different. And that's where I think the African-American metaphor is strongest. So like a young black male wearing a hoodie, by his very appearance, he is considered dangerous and feared. I wanted to tell a story like that, but I didn't want to talk about something that I had no personal experience with. I think in our current environment, everything is so charged, so fraught, so loaded, that just to show that scenario makes it hard for people to actually think about it, because they just go into their separate camps, you know.
Sure.
This seemed to me a way to explicate that through this sort of abstract idea of this other thing. So yeah, the stories, who controls the story? So he thinks differently. He understands what that is. He understands what these metaphorical stories are.
Right. He struggles to.
He doesn't accept them. He doesn't accept them. And he tries to accept them until I think he feels he understands how that's his own story has been written for him. And in some sense, he inevitably is forced to actually play his part in that story. And, you know, that's the tragedy of it.
I have to say that the scene where he goes to see the bog body of William Prime, we'll call him William Prime, I mean, it just blew my mind. Like, I've never seen a scene like that in a movie where somebody is looking at the thing they were cloned from.
It was so much fun to do that, and the prop was so good, and it was created by this partnership of a very specialized body-making guy. You know, I love the movie business for having these incredible specialty crafts. So that guy, and then the head was made from a life cast of the actor Will Britton, and that was created by the makeup guy who did such a good job. And I have to call him out because he was amazing and a real gentleman to work with, Stevie Bettles. So we combined those things, and it spoke to him because it was him, and so it all worked together in a really harmonious way. I feel so lucky to have been part of that. And that both actors in that scene are so great. Beth Grant, just fantastic.
Yeah, it was, like I said, something that I've never seen before.
I have the prop in my office. I made it into a coffee table.
Oh,
and
wow.
People who come in and they look at it, they're like, what is that?
So you said that perhaps maybe the Neanderthals were superior in a way that they were more...
Virtuous.
Virtuous, yeah. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that, you know, I don't want to, you know, the spoiler alerts, I don't want to talk
no
too much about what happens, but the way he thinks, I think, is more fundamentally honest, you know, which is a quality that we value, and yet we traffic in untruths on a daily basis, or at least shading the truth, or, you know, spinning everything. We're fighting about the story all the time. That's, you know, turn on the news, listening, you know, to radio in the car. It's a battle. Everybody's battling for the story. Who's right. going to control it? Who's going to tell it?
Yeah.
And you know, every piece of advertising is on one level a lie. You know, I mean, we all know that. It's not a profound thing to say that. But sometimes I just get beaten down by it. I just can't take it anymore, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So where do you stand on the whole bioethics of... Because I want to see the woolly mammoth come back to life.
I don't know how I feel about that. I think that, you know, creating a different kind of human without a plan for what kind of life he or she would have is, you know, is unethical. I can say that without reserve.
Of course. I still want to see it.
I know. It's a fascinating idea. And the woolly mammoth, you know, I mean, there's some discussion about how creating the woolly mammoth and allowing them to graze on the tundra would be a good thing for the environment. I don't know. I mean, they thought releasing frogs in Australia would be a good thing for the environment, and that was a bad idea. So I don't know. I think, again, humility should be the operating idea.
So, you have your last name. You have one of the most revered, beloved last names in America, the world. Maybe you can tell my listeners who your dad was and
sure.
a little bit about how he influenced you.
Sure. Well, my dad was named Roy Disney, and his dad was named Roy Disney, and so my grandfather, my father's father, was Walt Disney's brother and business partner. So the two brothers started the studio together. It was in its earliest days called the Disney Brothers Studio, and they decided that Walt was the creative guy and the charismatic front man, and so they changed the name to Walt Disney Studios after that. My grandfather was a wonderful man. He was the business guy, I guess you would say. He was the guy who made it actually happen.
Important.
Very important,
yeah.
You know, and he and my grandmother, you know, were really covered wagon people. I mean, these were working people from the Midwest, from the middle of the country. You know, their parents were literally laborers and migrants, you know, who grew up before radio, before cars. My grandmother was born in 1890.
Wow.
And
your grandmother.
Yes.
Not your great-grandmother.
Yes, my grandmother was born in 1890, and she talked about her brothers going off to the Spanish-American War in 1898. You know, she had memories of every single thing, every single technology that we take for granted now was created in her lifetime. And then these unlikely people created this unbelievable company. It's an amazing story.
Sure.
You know? So my dad worked there for his whole career. He made Sunday night TV shows when I was a kid, and I'm old enough to remember those in their original incarnation. Most people aren't these days, but
it was the wonderful world of Disney.
Yes, yeah. It was a staple of American life in the days when there were three networks and everybody watched the same thing. And you know, that world doesn't exist anymore. But it was so he made, I don't know, maybe 35 of those shows over the years, and they were all a boy and his dog kind of stories. A lot of them revolved around nature. He was very interested in animals. He was a very early conservationist. He was a very intellectual, broad-minded, interesting person, and he brought a lot of ideas into the house. He was a wonderful person, and I miss him.
How did he and your lineage inform you? How does it inform you as a filmmaker?
Well, I had the opportunity to work in the animation department in my younger days, and so I was there in the 80s when the animation was being revived. The whole golden age happened. I was there at the beginning of that. I co-wrote the screenplay for a movie called Oliver and Company, which some people remember.
Yeah.
At the time, it was the biggest selling movie of Disney in Disney history.
Sure.
And then it was eclipsed many times over by Little Mermaid, which was the next one, and then the next one, and the next one.
Yeah.
So it was really a fantastic experience to be there at that time. When I was working on Oliver, Howard Ashman's office was right next to mine, and he was composing the music for The Little Mermaid.
Wow.
And at the time, I found that annoying because I was trying to work and it was noisy. But it was really fantastic. I wrote a treatment for what became The Lion King. I claim no authorship over the movie. I was one of a million people who contributed to that. But the thing that I really took from that was the commitment to the highest quality, that they worked ideas and worked ideas and worked ideas until they just could become better and better and better. You know, it's, you know, the saying about getting, you know, 90% of the quality for 20% of the effort, and then it's just that last bit that takes so much more work, and they were just committed to doing that. And there were so many people, and everybody had good ideas, and it's just such an exciting thing to be there. I feel so grateful that I got that opportunity.
I love that William is sort of this kind of scientific fairy tale. And to me, that's really exciting because I love stories, but I also love science. So to see those two worlds come together was really exciting. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.